A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 7, The Early Days, Before the Persian Wars.
Well, over the next few years, the political situation in Greece and between Sparta and Athens and between both of them in Persia proceeds to get very complicated. Ruling in Athens for a while had been the family of the tyrant, a benign tyrant, as tyrants go, but the tyrant nonetheless, which is to say non-royal, one-man, strongman ruler, Pisistratus. He died. His son, Hippias, took over as tyrant in Athens. And historically, the Pisistrates, as they were called, and the Spartans had had pretty good relations. Despite Sparta's reputation for, where possible, working to oust tyrants, not only in the Peloponnese, but again, where possible, elsewhere, generally in favor of sympathetic oligarchs. Again, if possible. Well, the situation in Athens was relatively unstable, more so than it had been under Pisistratus, who had had his own problems. And in 514, there was an attempt, which was later much valorized by the Athenians as sort of the beginning moment of their liberty, when two conspirators, Aristaegeton and Harmodius, later celebrated as the tyrannicides, attempted to kill Hippias, but things didn't work out. They instead managed to kill his brother Hipparchus and were themselves executed. Meanwhile, relations with Sparta had soured to some degree. This is not entirely clear, but very likely because Hippias seemed to be in favor of relations with Persia, to have gone pro-Persian, to have medized, as the saying went at the time. Actually, the dominant groups in Persia were the Medes, who had previously been dominant, and then the Persians, who were closely akin. Cyrus himself was a Persian. Greeks, however, customarily referred to Persians as Medes. The Medism, or pro-Persian policy of Hippias, and the tyrannical character of his government led, first of all, to a failed attempt to oust him in 512, and then in 510, Cleomenes succeeded in removing Hippias from control in Athens. The situation in Athens thereafter remained relatively unstable. One of the leading politicians of Athens was a man in the very prominent Alcmaeonid family by the name of Cleisthenes. As a strongman or leader, however, Cleomenes favored Isagoras, another Athenian politician, and by malicious report, and perhaps truthfully, favored also, and to no small degree, Isagoras's very attractive wife. Be that as it may, he succeeded about 508 in forcing Cleisthenes to leave town. Cleisthenes, meanwhile, in his political jockeying, in order to secure his return to power, decided to take an unprecedented step. And the unprecedented step which Cleisthenes took was to involve the Athenian demos, to promise them a share in power if they would support him against Isagoras and other rival candidates. This, in the winter of 508-07, the Greek calendar, remember, began for most cities, Athens and Sparta included, at midsummer. So they thought of years as we think of, in effect, academic years. In the year 508-507, then, the reforms of Cleisthenes in favor of the demos, in effect, founded democracy in Athens. And Athens was, so far as we know, the first democracy on record, and a vastly more responsive and inclusive non-representative direct democracy than anything which remotely exists on a national level in the modern world. Well, meanwhile, Persia continued to be interested in expanding. Athens was negotiating with Persia, and in 507, though they got in some trouble for this, Athenian envoys offered earth and water to Persia. And to offer earth and water to Persia was, in effect, to accept Persian overlordship. The Athenians later repudiated the gesture of their envoys, but Cleomenes certainly was under the impression that the Alcmaeonids were pro-Persian, and indeed later Alcmaeonids, Pericles and Alcibiades among them, whom we will encounter later, certainly were more pro-Persian than they were pro-Spartan. In any case, in response to these difficulties, and perhaps to the perceived Medism now of Athens, or Medistic tendencies of Athens, Cleomenes in 506 decided once again to invade Attica and to depose Cleisthenes and the democracy if possible. At no point did Sparta approve of democracies. They preferred oligarchies. The Corinthians, as usual, were allied with the Spartans in this expedition in 506, but by this time, the rivalry between, on the one hand, Cleomenes, who was adamantly anti-Persian, and Demaratus, his brother king, the Eurypontid king, who was more or less pro-Persian, their rivalry had become really severe and troubling. As a result, as they were approaching Athens with Cleomenes in the lead, Demaratus pulled out or failed to show up with his Spartan contingent, and beyond that, persuaded the Corinthians to pull out as well. So Cleisthenes remained in power, and Cleomenes, who was none too fond of Demaratus before, was vastly less fond now. At this point, about 499, by the way, though Sparta was at something close to the peak of her power, Athens was not yet what she later became, and the city most like what Athens would become in terms of wealth, prominence, and cultural vibrancy was the city of Miletus, just opposite the island of Samos on the actual Aegean coast of Turkey, just a little bit to the south of Samos. And the people in Miletus were a bit restive under Persian rule, under their tyrant Aristagoras. They were contemplating a revolt, not just of Miletus, but indeed of as many of the Ionian Greeks as possible who were at that point under Persian control. And in order to gather strength for his proposed rebellion, Aristagoras of Miletus, came to Sparta and came to the house of Cleomenes, king of Sparta. During his negotiations with Cleomenes, Aristagoras noted to his annoyance the presence in the room, which would be a little bit surprising for a high-level diplomatic negotiation, which this assuredly was, of Cleomenes' only child, his 8 or 9 year old daughter, Gorgo. And Aristagoras did his best to persuade Cleomenes that he should participate in the revolt against Persian rule. That end in view, he brought with him something which was absolutely technologically cutting edge at this point, a map, which purported to show all of Persia, and he pointed out the Lydians and the Cappadocians and the Syrians and the Cilicians and the Armenians and so on and so on and so on, right to the Persian capital area in central Persia itself. And he tried to engage Cleomenes' interest in the vast wealth to be gained by conquest. Well, Cleomenes asked for a day to think things over. And when Aristagoras returned the next day, he said, I have one question. How far is it from the coast to the Persian heartland? And here, according to Herodotus, was where Aristagoras made his fatal mistake. His answer was 3 months, at which point the horrified Cleomenes said, my guest friend of Miletus, you must depart from Sparta before sunset. Your request will never be accepted by the Lacedaemonians if you intend to leave them on a 3 month journey away from the sea. Threw him out of the house. Then, however, Aristagoras decided he would come as a suppliant, and he began to offer bribes. First, 10 talents, if Sparta would help. Well, a talent is, in contemporary purchasing power, not $1 million, but close. Something like $700,000-$800,000. So 10 talents is a substantial sum. Cleomenes still turned him down. He kept upping the ante until he finally got to 50 talents, at which point, famously, as we've mentioned before, Gorgo reportedly said, Father, your guest friend is going to corrupt you unless you leave and stay away. Cleomenes, according to Herodotus, was pleased with his child's advice, went to another room, and Aristagoras departed, and the Spartans did not take place in the Ionian Revolt. Aristagoras, however, nothing deterred, or little deterred, went on to Athens, where he spoke to the Athenian assembly of about 30,000, and they went for it. Herodotus dryly observes it proved easier to corrupt 30,000 people than it did to corrupt one. Ordinarily, Herodotus is fairly pro-Athenian. In this case, perhaps, Sparta comes off best. In any case, Athens, which at this point was nothing like the naval power she would shortly become, detached 20 ships in 498, along with a few ships from Eretria, a city on the island of Euboea, which extends along the eastern coast of Greece between Athens and Thermopylae. And when the time came, Athens and Eretria both participated in the kind of bungled burning of the local Persian subcapital, regional capital of Sardis. This, as you might imagine, infuriated the Persians. This was presumption of, if not an unprecedented kind, a kind that had to be answered. When King Darius, who was now ruling Persia, first heard of what had happened, he asked, "Who are the Athenians?" as his father had asked, "Who are the Spartans?" a generation and a bit more before. And when he found out, was so incensed that famously he is said to have instructed an attendant to say to him every day at dinner, repeatedly, "Remember the Athenians, remember the Athenians who have so insulted you." Well, the Athenians actually soon thought better of their participation, and the Eretrians too, but the Ionian revolt continued from 499 or thereabouts to 494 and concluded in a way which, rather to my surprise, historians have not made much of, though to me it is very illuminating with regard to what would happen later on in the central phase of the Persian Wars themselves. Over the course of the next several years, the Persians conducted operations gradually reconquering the cities which had revolted, till finally in 494, Miletus and the other cities and islands which were still resisting Persia decide to concentrate their forces and risk all in a naval battle off the tiny island of Lade or Lade. Actually, the battle is so seldom discussed, I've never heard anyone else say the word. I presume that the English pronunciation is Lade, but in all honesty, I'm not dead sure about that. In any event, the Samians, the other Ionians, people from the island of Samos and the other islands and cities which were still free along the coast, and the people of Miletus themselves assembled a major fleet at the island of Lade, just off the coast from Miletus, to take on the Persian fleet. The Persian fleet actually requires a little bit of discussion. Persia itself was a land power, and if by Persian fleet one means fleet indigenous to Persia or manned primarily by Persians, there was no such thing. But in the previous generation or so, under the leadership of Cyrus's son Cambyses, the Persians had conquered Egypt, and in the process had also conquered Phoenicia, what's now Lebanon, in effect. And the Phoenicians were hands down, even the Greeks confessed, the most proficient sailors in the ancient world. Greeks themselves were probably second, and the Greeks never willingly conceded first place to anybody in anything in preference to themselves unless the evidence was absolutely incontrovertible. So the fact that the Greeks themselves thought of the Phoenicians as their maritime superiors suggests that they were. The Persian fleet, unsurprisingly, was largely Phoenician, with a substantial contingent from Egypt as well. And the Egyptians, while not Phoenicians, weren't bad. There were also a substantial number of Ionian Greeks in the Persian fleet. So it was a formidable and crack force. Nevertheless, the rebelling Ionians liked their chances better certainly than the prospect of simply surrendering or taking the Persians on in a land battle. And the Persians accordingly made an offer. And the offer was this, with regard to the Ionic coalition gathered at Lade against them. If you surrender or defect, there will be no penalties for your rebellion. You will go back to exactly the status quo ante, paying taxes and so forth, but there'll be no reparations or penalties. If you continue to fight against us, and as you will, you lose, then we will execute your adult males and enslave your women and children, and if you have any handsome boys, we'll castrate them and make eunuchs of them and send them on to Persia. Your call. This was a little dispiriting, and what happened at the Battle of Lade was, once the fleets prepared to engage, the sailors from the island of Samos, all but a few, and the ships from the island of Samos, all but a few, did in fact defect. A remainder fought heroically and fatally and lost, but most defected. And most of the other Ionians fled as well, leaving the Miletans to get their bacon out of the fire on their own, which they failed in doing, and the Persians kept their word with regard to Miletus and Miletus's days as a great cultural center and trading entrepot and leading light of the Hellenic world were over. This was so distressing to Athens, by the way, that the following year, a rival of Aeschylus entered the annual tragedy contest, the Festival of Dionysus, with a play entitled The Destruction of Miletus. The Athenians were so upset by that play, so appalled by what they were plenty aware enough to foresee as possibly their own fate depicted in the play, that they fined Phrynichus 1,000 drachmas for writing it and vowed that it should never be produced again. That's a little peculiar since, at least at this point, plays were ordinarily produced only once, but nevertheless, Phrynichus had to pay the fine, and a fine of 1,000 drachmas is about $20,000, so it was a real fine. The key point to remember, though, with a view toward the future, is that the first time the Persians and the Greeks met in a sea battle, lots of Greeks defected, and the Greeks were utterly trounced. This, by the way, a mere 14 years before the Battle of Salamis, which would have made every sailor in the fleets at Salamis well aware of those previous results. Meanwhile, the Persian threat with regard not only to Ionia, but also to Athens, certainly, and by extension to Sparta, was growing ever clearer. That was one factor contributing to the Spartan performance in the Battle of Scipia against Argos. Cleomenes was under the impression, probably rightly, that Argos was Medizing, though the motives of Argos in Medizing, my suspicion is this may have had more to do with the notion that the enemy of my enemy is my friend than any major affinity on the part of Argos for Persia. What the Argives seem to have liked about Persia was that the Spartans didn't like them. In any case, bad blood between Argos and Sparta being very long-standing, Cleomenes mounted an attack near Tiryns, quite close to Argos itself against the Argives at Sepia. They won a victory, and about 6,000 Argive warriors reportedly took refuge in a sacred grove. The Greeks took very seriously the notion that suppliants in a sanctified place were inviolable, and the Spartans, again, took such things more seriously than most, and everybody took them seriously. What Cleomenes accordingly did is managed to lure out of the grove about 50 of the Argives, whom he then immediately killed. But the Argives figured out what was going on and thereafter refused to leave. At which point, and this is pretty unedifying stuff, but here it is, Cleomenes had the helot retainers of his army set fire to the grove and burn alive the Argives who had taken refuge there. The reason for having the helots actually set the fire was the Spartans did not themselves want the ritual pollution. Well, this assured that when the time came, Argos would be, if not pro-Persian, neutral in any fight in which Sparta participated, and it also essentially knocked out Argos as a military power for the next generation. Meanwhile, in 492, Persian efforts were intensifying. Mardonius, closely connected to, indeed, in a sense, a member of the Persian royal family, mounted a fleet attack designed to take care of Athens, moving around the northern shore of the Aegean. But off Mount Athos, the fleet ran into a storm, which, ancient warships being notoriously unseaworthy, so severely damaged them that the attempt to punish Athens had to be called off. Meanwhile, Athens' great local enemy and trading rival at this early point, and naval rival, indeed at this point, naval superior, the island of Aegina, Medized. Persia was asking for earth and water from poleis all over Greece, and Aegina went along with it, perhaps under the encouragement of Cleomenes' rival king, Demaratus. The Athenians were worried by this. They, of course, were likewise anti-Persian. Aegina was their rival to begin with. They asked for Spartan assistance in deposing the people in Aegina who had Medized, and Cleomenes went over to Aegina and attempted to do just that, dealing with a recalcitrant gentleman in Aegina by the name of Creos, or Ram. Creos evidently had received from Demaratus a letter claiming that Cleomenes had no full Spartan authority for his efforts to change the policy of Aegina. This greatly irritated Cleomenes, who supposedly said to him after asking his name, Creos Ram, "Cover your horns in bronze then, Ram, because you are about to encounter great trouble," as indeed a later intervention brought about when Creos was sent to Athens as a hostage, and the decision of Aegina to Medize was reversed. The Athenians and Spartans themselves had meanwhile received envoys from Persia asking once again for earth and water, and they put themselves well beyond the possibility of compromise with their response at this time, around 492. The Athenians, through the Persian envoys, heralds who had sacrosanct status, in the pit where they put executed criminals, presumably having executed them beforehand, the Spartans threw the envoys down into a well to let them die, telling them in the process that once in the well, they could find all the earth and water they would have any use for. That was, for sure, little short of a declaration of war, and, as we will see, the war was not long in coming.
This ends Lecture 7.